Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the $662 billion defence authorisation bill the President threatens to veto. Lawrence Korb, who was Assistant Secretary of Defence in the Reagan administration and is now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, will look into provisions the White House opposes that would deny terrorist suspects, including American citizens, the right to a trial and subject them to indefinite detention, as well as the bill's imposition of harsh sanctions on Iran that could drive oil prices way up in an election year. Then we'll examine internal bickering amongst Iran's ruling elite that has paralyzed statecraft as radical elements in the regime take excessive risks to score petty victories over their domestic rivals. Dr. Trita Parsi, the author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, joins us to discuss this dangerous brinksmanship as outside pressure on Iran's nuclear ambitions intensifies. Then finally, a Republican businessman, Stanley Weiss, joins us. The founding chairman of BENS, Business Executives for National Security, a nonprofit group dedicated to a more rational, business-like approach to excessive defense spending. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Huntsman is the only electable Republican, which argues against conventional political punditry that John Huntsman could eventually be the last man standing in the Republican presidential race. I'm now joined by Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, and a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you.
And the president's threatened to veto the $662 billion defense bills that the Senate voted 93-7 last week. That is a pretty a pretty unanimous margin, is it not? And my understanding is that he may not have the override votes if in the House in particular. So where would you place the political fortunes of this bill?
Well, I'd say he's going to have a problem even with members of his own party on this. One of the amendments that says that we have to put sanctions on countries and companies that do business with Iran's central bank or purchase Iranian oil has been, you know, pushed by Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, who's a leading Democrat. So, yeah, I think he's going to have a very, very difficult time on each of those provisions. Senator Levin has worked with Senator McCain on the other amendment to the bill that deals with whether, in fact, that you can take American citizens in, who have been accused of being allied with al-Qaeda and try them in civilian courts.
So the objection the White House has, Lawrence Korb, to the sanctions on Iran, I take it that if you really go after the Iranian central bank, and it's already started to happen in a sense with the British reaction to the sacking of their embassy, but I take it that from the Iranian point of view, I don't know whether this is causa belli, but it is essentially putting their backs against the wall, and I take it that their recent behavior would indicate that they're not entirely rational players.
Well, again, I think that, as you pointed out in your introduction, there are some, you know, maneuverings within there between the speaker and the president and the ruling ayatollahs. But I think they're pretty rational, people. I mean, remember when Iraq attacked them and they were willing to settle for the status quo ante, you know, after losing hundreds of thousands of people. So I think that they are rational when it comes to their actions. Sometimes their rhetoric doesn't match it. But I think if you look at the sanctions thing, it could cause terrible problems for the people in Iran and maybe unite the various factions, many of which are not happy with the rule, with the rulers. It would impose pretty, you know, tough problems for their quality of life. And would also, I think, cause us problems with a lot of our allies, because this bill says that any country or company that does business with Iran's central bank or purchases Iranian oil, we would impose sanctions on them. I mean, China and India both purchase Iranian oil, and, you know, particularly with China, since we depend on them to, you know, lend us money to deal with our deficit, would be pretty devastating.
Well, my understanding, Lawrence Korb, is that already Iran has lost a major customer, India, because of threatened banking sanctions. And if they can't get the money to pay for their oil, they're clearly in trouble. Already their economy is in trouble. What do you think is the line that would be crossed here? I mean, the Saudis, of course, are in a kind of cold war with Iran, and they've been offering, I believe, around under the table that we'll pick up the slack. So two questions. What's the line that be crossed? And two, I take it the White House is thinking, you know, oil prices could really go up if a lot of oil is taken off the market, and that's not going to
I mean, there's no doubt, at least in the short term, until the Saudis could increase production, if in fact that's what they, you know, intended to do, the prices would go up substantially, and this would cause us problems at home as we're trying to recover from, you know, the financial crisis that we've had for the last couple of years. Eventually, the Saudis might be able to, you know, to make it up, but it's not going to help in the short term. And that's what we're trying to do, is get this economy going again in the short term. And the Chinese and Russians have given no indication that they'll go along with this. And then it would make it, you know, difficult, you know, to get the rest of the international community with us. And if it's just the United States, it's not going to have the same impact if you had, you know, the international community, which we've gotten to move along and increase sanctions, you know, since Obama's been in office.
But what then explains, Lawrence Korb, why Senate Democrats, and again, the margin, the Senate voted 93-7 to pass this defense authorization bill the president is threatening to veto. What's in it for liberal Democrats or the Democratic Party in general if oil goes up to, say, $8, $10 a gallon or whatever in an election year?
Well, obviously, when the economy doesn't do well, the people running the White House, the executive branch, gets blamed. The other, I think, the reason, you know, when you're in the Congress, it becomes easier to vote for something that has popular appeal. Americans are very upset about the Iranians. There was this attempt to, make an arrangement with the Mexican, you know, cartel to blow up a restaurant in Washington to kill the Saudi ambassador and other civilians. You've had the report of the International Atomic Energy Agency saying, you know, they're going ahead with their nuclear program. They've made, you know, threats to use nuclear weapons. They're trying to develop ballistic missiles. And so I think people are saying, you know, enough is enough. We have to do something. And I think there's also a concern that if you don't do something, you may end up, you know, with people wanting to use military force, which would be an even worse option.
Well, the president apparently marshaled, Defense Secretary Panetta as well as FBI Director Robert Mueller to make these arguments, and apparently Harry Reid didn't listen.
Well, obviously not, because I think I think a lot of people, you know, don't realize the complexity of these things and think this will show the Iranians and hopefully it'll be so severe that they'll stop their nuclear program. You know, it's interesting, for years the Congress would tell, you know, China they couldn't have most favored nation status. And, you know, that was till about 5 years ago, and then finally we got them to stop that. But the president would have to veto that each year, and then he was able to get enough to prevent the veto from being overridden.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, and professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, tyrants and weapons of mass destruction. Turning to the other aspects of the defense authorization bill that the White House opposes and intend to veto, these to do with detention of a suspected terrorist, even U.S. citizens who could be seized within our borders, and this would deny them the right to trial and subject them to indefinite detention. The civil liberties community is up in arms about this. How will that one play out, do you think? Again, is this one of those issues that is red meat to an angry public?
Well, I think so, since we've had a lot of these so-called lone wolves or lone operators who are American citizens who are, you know, threatening to commit terrorist acts in the United States. And again, you know, it's almost a veto-proof margin. It was like 93-6 was the vote, for this particular amendment. But again, if you step back and take sort of an unemotional look at this thing, you recognize that we have used our civilian courts to put a lot of these lone wolves or people trying to commit terrorist acts into jail. And the other thing is that in the long term, working through our civilian courts sends the message to people around the world that we are not what some of these groups are claiming that we are. And I think, you know, the whole idea of, we've seen it in our past, we've sacrificed civil liberties for people when we panicked after, you know, the attacks, for example, on Pearl Harbor in World War One with the, you know, some of these laws that we passed. But I think, you know, if you step back and you take a look and you say, do we really want to be what these people claim we are?
Well, that argument, though, frankly, Lawrence Korb, has not been made very effectively, I don't believe, by the administration, particularly in regard to the damage that torture has done to the United States' reputation around the world, because the people like Gaddafi and Mugabe and all of these people are now free to say, well, what's your problem? You know, the U.S. does it, too. I mean,
that's right. You know, and I think, you know, this struggle with these violent extremist groups like al-Qaeda is not going to be won by killing them or capturing them. All it's going to be won by stopping people from joining them by, you know, undermining their narrative. I mean, one of the great things that happened was the Arab Spring and getting rid of a lot of the, you know, the people like dictators like Mubarak, who groups like al-Qaeda were claiming we were propping up and keeping in power, and they were not true Islamists, and allowing, you know, the elections where the Islamist parties can run. I think that's the way, you know, that we need to be going. Obviously, there's some risks involved in that, and there are obviously some risks. If you put a person on trial, he or she may, may be able to, quote-unquote, beat the system. But in the long run, it's not something that's going to hurt us.
So is there anything in this bill, Lawrence Korb, relating to Homeland Security? Because I was speaking with some of the Occupy movement people who were also demonstrating against the bill, and they're concerned about the militarization of police, et cetera. But I haven't been able to find anything in it. Is there something that you know about?
No, I mean, they are concerned because they say the policemen are acting like military people when they, you know, quote unquote, storm these parks and things like that. No, I haven't seen anything. I mean, there were 275 amendments proposed. It was one amendment I was hoping that they would pass, which they didn't. I don't know if you realize this. If a woman in the military is raped or a victim of incest, she has to pay for her own abortion at a military hospital. And to me, that's outrageous, particularly for some young enlisted, you know, person. And you know, there were, unfortunately, a lot of issues of sexual violence committed against military women, particularly enlisted people.
Now, this is not uncommon, is it?
No, unfortunately, it is a problem the military recognizes. You know, about 80% of these rapes go unreported. I should say issues of sexual violence go unreported, and because if you do, you know, it can hurt your career. And the whole idea that, you know, if you want to have an abortion and you're a victim of rape or incest, if you are civilian health care plan, they will pay for it. If you're in prison, they'll pay for it. But a military woman who are serving, her country has to pay for it. To me, that made no sense, but unfortunately, a lot of so-called pro-life people, you know, refused to let that come up for a vote.
So just in the last few minutes, Lawrence Korb, just to change the subject slightly, although we are going to be talking about internal politics within Iran and what is going on amongst the infighting with the regime, the Iranians are now claiming that they have intact an RQ-170 stealth drone known as the Sentinel, which was apparently lost over Afghanistan. What do you think? What condition do you think this plane would be in, if, assuming that they have it?
Well, if they shot it down, it wouldn't be in very good condition. I don't think they did shoot it down. I think we lost control of it, and they're flying on the Afghan-Iranian border, and it probably ended up crashing someplace in Iran. And they'll get some, providing it wasn't a violent crash, they're going to get some very good intelligence on it. And these are, you know, things that happen when you're using these unmanned drones, as we are so much in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's remarkable that this has not happened before.
So what this is, of course, the super secret one that was used keep an eye on Osama bin Laden's compound prior to the U.S. raid, and it presumably can evaded Pakistani radar, and it has apparently a long loitering ability, so it can stay up there for a long time. The Iranians are claiming that they hacked into its guidance and therefore captured it. If that's true, then the whole drone program is vulnerable.
Yeah, they claim that, but I don't think that's true at all, because they are very, very sophisticated, using, satellites and stuff. I would be dumbfounded if, in fact, they did. I'm not surprised that's what they're claiming, because, again, they would like to show, get us to, worry about being able to use those things. Because even though they're flying over Afghanistan territory, they've been able to spy on Iran. I mean, if you given, the scope of that they can take in. So I'm not surprised that they're saying that. But I just don't think, I mean, given the sophistication of that communication, I would be dumbfounded if they did that. Just like if they said they recovered it after they shot it down, I don't think, that makes sense either.
Well, it's surely a possibility, though, that since there are so few of these, apparently there's only a handful of these new, they're sort of like a small version of the B-2 bomber, these unmanned Sentinel drones. Isn't it possible that we've also been using them to look at the Iranian nuclear facilities?
Well, I wouldn't doubt it. As I say, even flying over Pakistani airspace, you can do that, or flying over Iraqi airspace, you can do that.
Mm-hmm. So it's possible that the story that somehow they lost control of it in Afghanistan, it may well have been over Iran when they lost control of it.
Well, it could have been.
It ended up somewhere in Iran, but I don't know where.
Yeah, well, we really don't know, but I have no doubt that even over Afghan airspace that they were able to gather intelligence about what's happening in Iran, because you look at that border, they're right next to each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for joining us, Lawrence Korb. And when do you think we'll know about this veto? When will it actually happen, do you think?
Well, I mean, they're going to try and get it, pass the bill before Congress adjourns. And I think if it's vetoed, it'll be the first one in recent memory. I do know that President Ford vetoed a defense authorization bill, but it's been a long time since, that has happened. And, of course, if he vetoes it, and assuming even if he can, get the veto sustained, then you're going to have to pass the bill again. And don't forget, this is for the fiscal year that started 1 October. So we're already late into the year.
So who's got the leverage?
Well, right now, with that vote, it would seem to me that the Senate has it, because, again, the Pentagon wants to get the money to get going, and it's already causing some managerial problems, and it'd be embarrassing for the president to have his veto not sustained, particularly in one of the branches of government controlled by the Democrats.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Lawrence Korb.
Okay, nice to be with you.
And I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, and a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about internal struggles within the ruling elite in Iran.
فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. He is the author of Treacherous Alliance in the Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and the upcoming book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you have been writing, you have a piece in the Huffington Post about the internal battles within the Iranian ruling elite. I think it was pretty clear during the takeover of the British embassy by the Basij militia that there's something amiss, right, where you have somebody authorized the militia to take the embassy. And on the other hand, you have Ahmadinejad's friend, the foreign minister, condemning the raid itself. Where does that battle stand between Ahmadinejad and I take it it's not only is he has a problem with the supreme leader, but he also has a problem with the Speaker of the Parliament, Ali Larijani.
Correct. I think the immediate assumption by a lot of observers was that the takeover of the embassy had a lot to do with the latest round of sanctions that the Europeans had announced that they would impose on the Iranian regime and the Iranian country, Iran as a whole. And I think there is definitely some truth to that, but there's also that missing internal dynamics angle that I think is important to take into consideration. The background to this was that the Ahmadinejad government, for their own political ends and ambitions, have been trying to see if they can deal with the United States and the Europeans, see if they could open up a channel of communications and negotiate. And there's been some interest on the Western end to do so as well, and there's been feelers sent back and forth. And at the same time, other elements in the Iranian government who strongly oppose Ahmadinejad for their own reasons, do not necessarily oppose the idea of negotiations, but they certainly don't want Ahmadinejad to conduct those or to get credit for any deal that potentially could come out of that. So when Ahmadinejad and his foreign minister was pushing for getting the British ambassador accredited, the Larijani clan in the circle in the parliament used that as an opportunity to push for a resolution that calls for the British ambassador to be expelled out of Iran and a downgrading of relations with the United Kingdom. That resolution passed the Iranian parliament last Sunday, but it couldn't come into effect until Ahmadinejad would sign and implement it. He, however, pushed back, and so did his foreign minister. And that's the point in which the Larijani circle calls in the mob, essentially a mob of about 300 Basijis who stormed the embassy, broke into it, vandalized it, Fortunately, no hostages were taken, and in a couple of hours, it was all over. But they achieved their objective, and the objective was to undermine the atmosphere so that no conflict resolution could take place.
Well, but surely, as collateral damage, Dr. Tridipasi, the impression that the rest of the world is given, and particularly with echoes of the original hostage taking back in 1979 of the American embassy, is it reinforces this notion that Iran is a rogue state and it doesn't play by the international rules, and which is the subtext, surely, of the pressure on Iran over its nuclear program.
Absolutely, because this is just simply against diplomatic code to break into another country's embassy, to vandalize it, to hurt the people. And unfortunately, this time around, that did not happen. But nevertheless, this is a very, very bad omen. And again, it shows how easy it is for radical elements to further undermine the atmosphere and make it next to impossible to actually see some constructive process in the making. What's important to note here, though, that this is not done because Larijani necessarily opposes diplomacy. It's because he opposes Ahmadinejad. When Larijani was the negotiator a couple of years ago, when he was a nuclear envoy of Iran, it was actually Ahmadinejad who was doing things of this nature to undermine Larijani. And what it shows is that Iran, even though it's a very important country, because of the deterioration of statescraft there, you have foreign policy decisions being made on the basis of petty domestic rivalries. And that is taking place not in an ordinary circumstance, but in a circumstance of extremely heightened tensions to begin with. That's a very dangerous combination.
So are there any adults in the room? I mean, I take it that the supreme leader, who has the ultimate say, he also has his problems with Ahmadinejad.
Certainly, and I personally do not believe that all of this could have happened had there not been an endorsement from very, very high levels. And it shows that, unfortunately, right now, there aren't any adults in the room. Now, the Iranians may come back and argue and say, well, this, at the end of the day, was a limited thing. It didn't lead to any hostage taking. It was over in a couple of hours. Even so, if that's the case, it doesn't matter. This is a breach of the diplomatic code. It's a violation of international law. It simply should not happen. Now, the Iranians make the argument that the British are involved in espionage in Iran. That is probably true. They accuse the Brits of having something to do with the assassination of the various nuclear scientists. We don't know if that's true or not. Regardless of what the arguments are, if there is a case, the case should be brought to the international courts, to the General Assembly, to the Security Council, rather than this completely despicable act of violating diplomatic code and vandalizing the embassy.
And Dr. Tridipasi, again, Professor of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Study and the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, which is the largest Iranian American group in the country. He's also the author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and the upcoming book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Let's talk a little about Obama's diplomacy with Iran, since we just had Larry Corbon talking about the defense authorization bill that is the president's threatening to veto because of, among other things, because of provisions that would sanction the Iranian Central Bank. And I take it that the president feels that it's too much and it's going to put Iran's back to the wall. And in the climate we're talking about, where there's been irrational behavior going on, that would seem to be an incendiary thing. Now, I understand the president's concern is that he doesn't want to run in a presidential election next year with gasoline at $8 a gallon.
Certainly, yes. And I think, to be frank, there's a very small likelihood that these sanctions would be effective in actually bringing about the objectives of the United States. We had these type of sanctions on Iraq. It killed 500,000 Iraqis, a lot of them children. It did not bring down Saddam Hussein's government. In fact, it paved the way for the disastrous war that took place after 2003. And in this specific circumstance, you do have a situation in which if these type of sanctions were to be imposed, it certainly would shock the oil markets. And for every dollar that the oil price goes up, we pay for it at the gas stations. And when we pay for it at the gas station, that means that there's going to be less jobs created in the United States. So I think it's understandable that the administration is doing some pushback against this measure because it really would spell disaster. What I would like to personally see is a much more bold position from the administration pushing back against these futile measures and actually doubling up on the type of diplomacy that could be successful.
So this, but this passed something, this one particular amendment, I think, passed 97-3 in the Senate. So I asked Larry Korb this question, why are Liberal Democrats creating a condition that may punish the Democratic Party and their president in the next year's election?
Well, the forces that are lobbying for this bill are very, very powerful. And I think, unfortunately, too many of these senators are not thinking of the larger good here. They're not thinking of the national interest. They're thinking much more short-sightedness. And in fact, if you take a look at the hearing where Senator Menendez, one of the key sponsors of this sanctions bill, a Democrat, was arguing in a very, very hostile way with Undersecretary of State Wendy Sherman, who's, of course, a Democrat as well. So this is an issue that at this stage transcends partisanship and is more of the executive branch facing a lot of pressure from Congress as a whole.
Well, Larry Korb's final analysis was that that the Senate has the leverage and that the president's probably going to fail in the veto. It'll be overridden.
I would tend to agree with Larry on that issue, and I would say that because of the relatively poor track record that the president has when it comes to effectively handling Congress. This is not just on the Iran issue, but it's on a lot of other issues. This president, even though he came in with a tremendous amount of popularity, strong majority in the Congress, both in the House and the Senate, has not had a particularly effective way of utilizing that to push forward his agenda. I think he's been, frankly, surprisingly inept at handling Congress.
So it will go into play then. We will have a spike in oil prices. And the Iranian people get punished by these sanctions. That's your argument. That was also Larry Korb's argument, that they're not targeted against the IRGC or the ruling elite.
I think it is quite likely that some variation of it will pass. Now, will it be the final version that the senators are pushing for, or will it be some sort of watered-down version? We don't know yet. I think some version will be passed. But whichever version it is, I think it is bad news. And I think if the administration had been a little bit more proactive from the very outset, and instead of trying to position itself to the right of the Republicans and positioning itself to come across as if it's tougher than anyone else has been, actually go to Congress, go to the American public and say it lies in our national interest to pursue a sustainable, patient, diplomatic process to resolve this issue with Iran, because it's a very, very dangerous conflict. We don't want to see it get out of control, and we don't want to take short-sighted measures that actually end up punishing ourselves more than anyone else.
Well, I've been trying to follow for some time, Dr. Tridipasi, rumors of war, and particularly involving an Israeli strike on the Iranian nuclear facilities, and you know, I've interviewed people like Bob Baer, and we got a lot of blowback. Went all over, went viral around the Middle East. But the sources were
Remember that interview.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. The sources were all top Israeli intelligence people, and they're still concerned about Netanyahu. But my understanding from talking to Israeli intelligence people is that there's also an element in this of that Netanyahu is putting the screws on, threatening an attack on Iran, which everybody recognizes would be incredibly damaging to everybody in the world, and Israel too. That this is a part of putting pressure on the United States to have more effective sanctions against Iran, to really cripple the regime. So, do you buy that?
I do believe that there is a strong political angle to this, in which the Israelis are making the argument to the United States that unless you put tough sanctions on Iran and get as many countries as possible to go along with those sanctions, unless that happens, Israel will be forced to take military action. The United States then takes the same argument, makes it to the Europeans, and essentially twists the arms of the Europeans to get them to go along with these sanctions. And then the Europeans and the U.S. together go and make the same argument to the Russians, the Chinese, and everyone else in the world that now we have to do this, otherwise the Israelis will take military action. I think it's been done several times now. It had some effect. But in the last round, the Russians and the Chinese essentially were like, no, we're not going to do this because we don't believe that Israel is going to actually bomb. And even if Israel would bomb, going for more of these sanctions only brings us closer to a military confrontation anyways. So as a result, going for sanctions is not an alternative to war. It's actually something that expedites war.
Well, but you have to add this extra fly in the ointment, surely, Dr. Tridipasi, and that is the Saudis are also on the same page as Netanyahu.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's been clear for some time, that even though in the past the Saudis did not explicitly or publicly make statements similar to those of the Israelis, behind the scenes, according to the WikiLeaks documents, they clearly have been saying things as hawkish, if not even more hawkish than what the Israelis were saying. But not a lot of attention was brought to the Saudis because they were not doing it publicly and they were kind of flying under the radar. But there has been a lot of pressure, both from the Saudis and the Israelis, for the Obama administration to consistently toughen its policy. And that was particularly problematic in 2009 when the Obama administration actually tried extensively with diplomacy, and they were faced with so many problems. They were faced with the problems that the Iranians were causing. They were faced with the problems that Congress was causing and all of the different obstacles that the Saudis and the Israelis were putting in front of them.
So just in the last minute, what is your understanding? Do you have any information on this drone, the Sentinel, this very sophisticated stealth aircraft that was apparently lost over Iran?
I don't have any information beyond what is already out there in the public, and it's been acknowledged that at least whether the Iranians shot it down or not, one of them has gone missing, so it seems likely that the Iranians are in possession of it. And I think what's dangerous with this is that we are in a conflict dynamic right now. The United States is trying to figure out all new different types of ways of putting pressure on the Iranians, and the Iranians are trying to see how they can put pressure on the United States. And in those circumstances, an incident like this could actually spark a much larger conflict because we don't have any communication. We don't have any de-escalatory mechanisms. We are actually in a very, very fragile situation. It could very easily deteriorate. And we saw how the markets reacted to this news, how the media market reacted to this news as well. I think a lot of countries are very tense right now, and they're afraid that something will happen, not because there's a plan to go to war, but because there's so many things that are so tense right now. There's no diplomacy. There's no effort to actually de-escalate things, and that's very, very dangerous.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dr. Tridipasi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Tridipasi, Professor of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. He's the author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and the upcoming book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a Republican businessman who argues that John Huntsman will be the last candidate standing.
Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my youth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stanley Weiss, who's the founding chairman of Business Executives for National Security, a nonpartisan organization of senior executives who use the best practices of business to strengthen the nation's security. He's a former fellow at Harvard Center for International Affairs and a member on the Council on Foreign Relations, and has an article at the Huffington Post out now, "Huntsman is the Only Electable Republican." Welcome to Background Briefing, Stanley Weiss.
Yes, thank you.
And your article certainly caught my attention in as much as...
Before I begin anything, I want you to know that my views that I express in this article and every other article that I've written for the last 20 years or so are my own. They're not Ben's articles.
That's Business Executives for National Security.
I have to be very, very careful, and I am very careful to understand that... Benz does not involve itself in partisan political views or national security or other things than things that we feel as business executives we can achieve. Now, once we understand that, as an American citizen, I write what I like, and so I do this.
Well, you've written something that is surprising in the sense that the rest of the media basically have written off Huntsman, and I know that he's working assiduously in New Hampshire. What leads you to believe that he might pull this off?
Well, begin with, if you take a look at the Republican candidates, they're sort of each one kinds of, it's really, as I tried to express, it's sort of like being at a carnival. I mean, they go up, they go down, some are out, some are in. Now, Mr. Gingrich, who I think a great deal of, is at the moment up. My suspicion is he'll go down, and it eventually will end up with Mitt Romney, who I also think is really very capable, except I don't think that they're going to want him. And so I think that Ambassador Huntsman has really been holding off and waiting for each one to destroy themselves, which they're doing a very good job of doing.
The latest being Herman Cain, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, there'll be, and you know, that there's some, which I have some regard for, like Ron Paul. At least he's who he is. He's not electable, I don't think, but I respect him because I think he has certain integrity. And others keep going up and down and back and forth. I don't think that's the case with Huntsman. I think that he is who he is, and so I think it'll take a bit, but, you know, well, such a time scale that everything is just every minute. And my guess is, and as I've written, I think that he's going to do very well in New Hampshire, and that's going to propel him to a point because he's the only one who makes great sense.
Well, of course, the conventional belief in the media is that he may make sense, and he is certainly the most moderate and the most informed, I think, of all of the Republican candidates. But the conventional wisdom is that the Republican primary electorate is very, very conservative, very influenced by Christian evangelicals and by the Tea Party, and that he doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell, as they say.
Well, he is, after all, he's pro-life. He's pro-business. He's very religious. He, as I wrote, favors even Congressman Paul Ryan's budget plan. But the fact that he thinks that global warming is real is what seems to me any normal person would feel if you're really interested more in what's real than getting elected. And I think one of the things that he has, once the independents come in, and, of course, we have a big problem in our country these days, since the old smoke-filled rooms are finished, unfortunately, in my view, is that the extremes of votes right and left get there. And so they pick these kind of people. But most Americans are centrists, and he is center-right. I mean, certainly very conservative in almost all things, except things that are just so obviously wrong that he does think so. He's not moderate at all. Very clearly conservative.
But what leads you to believe, Stanley Weiss, that the Republican primary voters think like you do, that this is a circus? And you didn't say it was embarrassing, but I took that from your remarks, and that therefore they would want to gravitate towards somebody with real experience who doesn't have all of that baggage.
First of all, he has no baggage whatsoever. That's one of the interesting things about him. I think he's really waiting for each one to destroy themselves, and they're doing a very good job. And so ultimately, they'll end up with a kind of maybe Gingrich or Romney kind of thing, and they'll say things to themselves, well, do we really want to get rid of President Obama or not? And then the one person, and of course this will depend very much, in my view, on what happens in New Hampshire. He hasn't tried at all to do anything in Iowa. In New Hampshire, he, and with lots of money from the family, put a lot of money into New Hampshire, and I think if he does okay there, doesn't have to even win, but if he comes second or third there, I think then he'll be now in the race. I mean, he'll no longer be sort of number 1%. He'll be all of a sudden something else percent. I mean, after all, Romney's been 25% forever, and these others keep going up and down like a roller coaster, which is what I used.
That's the circus metaphor. Again, I'm speaking with Stanley Weiss, as the founding chairman of Business Executives for National Security. He has a piece in the Huffington Post, Huntsman is the only electable Republican. Now, of course, again, the conventional wisdom has been that Romney is the most electable Republican. You're suggesting that there's somebody even more electable, and that's Huntsman. If Gingrich gets the nomination, of course, he's already said that he's going to get it. My sense would be, Stanley Weiss, that that might lead to a third-party challenge. In other words, if you have a Republican nominee who's not electable in the eyes of people like you and a lot of Republicans, wouldn't that lead to the possibility of a third-party candidate entering?
No, I don't think that that's really in the cards. If indeed Gingrich becomes the Republican nominee, I think that all of the Republicans will stand behind him. I'm not sure that the independents will, but I think Republicans will, and I think he'll lose. But I think that Gingrich is very bright most of the time, but if you get a guy like Huntsman, I mean, if you really listen to him, I mean, he makes so much sense. As I wrote, I mean, he was chosen by the enemy, in quotes, to be our ambassador to China. So he's a kind of a person who would be able to deal, he speaks Mandarin, to be able to discuss things with the Chinese in a way that would make our country. He was a very successful three-time senator. He was a governor twice in Utah. Did a very good job. You know, he's not maybe a bundle of fun. Well, I don't think Abraham Lincoln was a bundle of fun, but in certain ways, I think of him as a kind of a person. He's better looking than Abraham Lincoln, which maybe is a disadvantage. But in any event, he says what he says, and I think what his idea is just to wait for the rest of them to destroy themselves. And when it comes down to the end, I think that the Republican Party will be intelligent enough to pick the one person who can beat President Obama. And there's only one. That's, in my view, is John Huntsman.
And so far in the presidential debates, when you mentioned China and his resume as having been President Obama's ambassador to China, there's no question that Huntsman was the only person who made any sense, but the rest of the candidates were China bashing, as though China bashing is popular with the Republican base. So how's Huntsman going to overcome that?
Well, I don't think that he wants to overcome anything. His viewpoint is that we're going to have to live with a very strong China. I think he understands very well, and I think he probably has something to do with the one thing that President Obama has done really very well, is to make a position in Asia, which is very clear to the Chinese that we're there. Now, if you want to get some president who really knows the place and knows China, know something, you want to get somebody who's actually been our ambassador, who speaks their language, and is tough as hell. Yeah, it's very possible that the Republicans will want to commit suicide and get somebody else.
Well, Stanley Weiss, you're just back from Europe, and my understanding is that unless the Europeans get their act together by December the 9th, which is quite soon, there's a likelihood that the euro will crash, and surely that will have effects on the 2012 election here in the United States, not to mention adversely affecting the global economy. So given in a paradoxical way that you could make the argument that President Obama's re-election fate is in the hands of Angela Merkel, what's your analysis then is if the worst happens in Europe and impacts the election here, how is that going to favor the Republican candidates?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's going to happen. Mrs. Merkel is not going to let that happen. For better or for worse, Germany is really the country that's going to make a decision about what to do. I think she already has. My conversations that I've had when I was just there as such, and they really are not in terrible shape. They did things badly, but that's an entirely other conversation. I don't think we want to talk about that, do we?
Only in the extent to which it's been suggested that the time is running out and you're confident that they're going to make the right decision and get their act together. My understanding from having spoken to a number of economists lately who have been involved in the studying the Eurozone is that Europe has the resources but so far hasn't shown the capability to deal with the crisis. You're telling us that they...
Well, I mean, even if that's so, it's simply going to sort of reinforce the viewpoint that, if they can't do it, and I'm not sure that we've really helped very much in what they're doing, and so I think it'll just make it less difficult for a Republican to win the next election.
So you wouldn't then go with the argument that you need to elect a Romney, or in your case, you're arguing for a Huntsman, in a bad economy, because essentially if the economy gets much worse, you could pretty much elect anybody, right? Isn't that the...
Well, I think Romney would be just okay. You know, he would be just fine. It's my only sense is for whatever reasons, he's not terribly popular. And Huntsman, you're going to hear lots about in the next weeks, really, certainly in months. And all of a sudden, Huntsman is going to be somewhere. He was like nothing, the 1%. And in certain polls, I hear he's now the fourth in the group. I mean, he hasn't done anything yet. I mean, he's just waiting for each one to destroy themselves. So I'm not in charge of it. It's not what I do.
Right.
My only sense I'm a businessman. I've been in the mining business all my life until I started Benz. And I write. And I have for the last 20 years or so. And I have views about certain things. I wrote some years ago about that our views about Myanmar, which we continue calling Burma, was wrong. And I had a hunch about a month ago that John Huntsman was going to be the only electable Republican. And so I wrote about it.
Well, just in closing, Stanley Weiss, do your Republican friends in the business community share your view? Because I'm not sure, you mentioned Abraham Lincoln earlier, I'm not sure today's Republican Party is even the same party of Eisenhower or even let alone George H.W. Bush.
Well, it would be if John Huntsman became president.
I see. So
I'm not saying that he should be the president.
Right.
I'm saying that he's the only electable Republican. And so consequently, whether or not he or President Obama should win the election is for the American people to decide.
Right, but if you want the Republican Party to return to its more traditional roots and its less evangelical Tea Party roots, then you would hope that a Huntsman would get elected. And if
I would, but I think the Tea Party gets a bad rap because I know lots of people in the Tea Party who are perfectly normal people. I know lots of people who are occupying City Hall who are perfectly normal people. Well, a little bit abnormal, if you're going to do that. That's America. I mean, for goodness sakes, that's the way we act. And I mean, my sense for Ambassador Huntsman is that he's just holding back and waiting and waiting. And I think he's putting money now into New Hampshire, and we'll see.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Stanley Weiss.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Stanley Weiss, who is the founding chairman of Business Executives for National Security, which is a nonpartisan organization of senior executives who use the best practices of business to strengthen the nation's security. He is formerly a fellow at Harvard Center for International Affairs and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has an article in the Huffington Post, "Huntsman is the only electable Republican." So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, Lawrence Korb, to talk about the defense authorization bill that the president's threatening to veto and what is it in the bill that the president objects to. Among the idea that this bill will deny terrorist suspects, including American citizens, the right to a trial and subject them to indefinite detention. If that's not unsavory enough, the bill also imposes harsh sanctions on Iran that'll drive up oil prices in an election year. But believe it or not, the Democrats in the Senate, who control the Senate, voted something like 97-3 in favor of these sanctions. So I don't know whether they're committing suicide or not. I asked Lawrence Korb that, and he seemed to think that the president is going to lose this one. And not to mention the fact that you already have a very touchy regime in Tehran with feeling paranoid, and we may well be seeing $8 a gallon gasoline next year. Go figure. I try to get further information about this from Dr. Trita Parsi. He's the head of the Iranian-American Council, which is the largest Iranian-American group in the country. He thinks that the president has not handled the relations with the Congress very well, will indeed lose this round. So it could have some severe impact on the election. He basically joined us to talk about divisions within the ruling elite in Tehran, where very petty personal rivalries are playing out against the international stage. And when you take over embassies and break international law just to score, as apparently the Speaker of the Parliament, Larijani, did against Ahmadinejad, it makes you wonder whether there are any adults in the room in Tehran. And I also, of course, in both cases, asked about this stealth plane that was shot down or lost or whatever over Iran. And, of course, there's not a lot of information about that available, although I think it's fairly likely, one, that the plane was, in fact, looking at the Iranian sites, and two, it's the claim that somehow the Iranians had hacked into the system. Apparently, that is next to impossible. One would think so. Otherwise, all their, these drones would be vulnerable. But, you know, hackers do have their way. Finally, I spoke with Stanley Weiss, a Republican businessman, just to get a feeling for how Republicans feel about this race. He thinks that Huntsman is the only electable Republican and made a good case, and in fact says that he basically has a strategy of waiting the others out and that all these clowns go up and down. It's like a circus. And eventually he's going to wait them out and pour a lot of money into New Hampshire at the last minute and start to emerge after the others have beaten each other up. We'll wait and see. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up and also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.